Working all kinds of technical stuff today. What I want to do today while he's getting set up is mention, I want to begin a series of sermons. I think it was maybe about 3 weeks ago. I gave a sermon on Caesarea. I understand the transmission wasn't that great, but I have prepared some PowerPoint messages on cities that I have visited in the Middle East. And as I said, I think there's some important lessons we can learn from the cities that are there that have long history. Some of them are pretty dynamic, like Jerusalem, for example. And so I thought today what I would introduce is the topic of what the Bible has to say about Jerusalem, past, present, and future. And today what I hope to accomplish is to go through during the sermon time is the Old Testament history of the city of Jerusalem in the Babylonian. It's named after the Babylonian, Jerusalem. And then we'll talk about the history of Jerusalem in the Old Testament. And then we'll have a break. And then in the Bible study, we'll come back in here. We won't do a round table today. We'll come back in here and we'll talk about Jerusalem in the New Testament. And we'll come right up to the time when the book of Acts ends. And then next time we'll start getting into the prophecies of Jerusalem and the prophecies of the Middle East, and we'll dissect those a little bit, like the evening and morning sacrifices. You know, how's that going to happen? And the abomination of desolation and some very important prophecies that are associated with the city of Jerusalem. We'll get into that next time we do a sermon Bible study. So I'll do two more segments on the history and the future of Jerusalem at that point. Anyway, so that's my plan today, is we'll talk about Jerusalem in the Old Testament. A little general background. Let's see, have we got the sermon up? Let's see if our little clicker's working. Aha. This is a Google aerial satellite map of the area, just in case none of you know where Jerusalem is. It's located almost equidistant between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea on a saddle or a ridge of mountains that are about 2,500 to 3,000 feet in elevation. So Jerusalem itself is a very arid region. It gets snow in the wintertime occasionally, and because of its elevation, like our mountains here, it's very similar to the Southern California climate or the Central California climate up in Jerusalem. As I said, this city is known from the Babylonian word Jerusalem, which means abode of peace. Abode of peace. It is today the capital of Israel, although other nations of the world do not recognize it as the capital. Other nations of the world, including the United States, only recognize Tel Aviv as the capital. But Israel has set up their Knesset, you know, their ruling building, like we have the capital. They've done all this in Jerusalem. But as you know, because Jerusalem is an international city, and it was declared so under the Balfour Declaration of 1947. They consider Jerusalem not the capital of Israel today, even though the Israelis consider it their capital. So it's a controversial city, as all of you know. The population is about 800,000 in its region, so it's a big city for the Middle East. It covers about 48 square miles within the city limits. It is a divided city. In fact, it has a 30-foot concrete fence running down part of the middle of it. Not the old city, but separating East Jerusalem, that is on the other side of the Mount of Olives, there's this big concrete fence that separates East Jerusalem from Jerusalem and West Jerusalem today. And if you go there, that's one of the big surprises I noticed. I went first in 1980 to Jerusalem, and then I went back again in 2007, and I was shocked to see this big fence there, which separates the Palestinians from the Israelis, basically, this big fence. It is located in the Judean Mountains, as I said, equidistant between the Mediterranean and the Dead Seas. It is considered a holy city for three major Abrahamic religions. Anybody know what those are? Christianity, Judaism, and for the Muslims, it's their third holiest site, right behind Mecca and Medina, is Jerusalem. It is a very important city to all of the monotheistic religions of the world. It is considered to be the origin of Christianity. The Catholic Church would say it is because the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ occurred there. We would say this is where the Holy Spirit came to the church on Pentecost, which we're coming up on next Sunday. So I thought it would be appropriate to maybe talk about the significance of the city, particularly in the Old and New Testament today. Within the old city of Jerusalem, which I'll show you in a little more detail in a moment, you have the Temple Mount, the Western Wall, and the Church of the Holy Sepulcher. The Western Wall is the holiest place for Jews in the world. And the reason it is because when the Holy of Holies was destroyed by Tiberius in 70 AD, they believed that the Holy Spirit went into the foundation of the temple platform. Closest to the Holy of Holies is the Western Wall. That's why the Jews consider the Western Wall the closest thing to God's Holy Spirit on earth today. And so if you go to the Western Wall, you'll find that Jews will put down their prayers on little pieces of paper, and they'll roll them up, and they'll stick them in the cracks between the platform rocks. And again, we'll take a closer look at that. The Church of the Holy Sepulcher is declared by the Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox Church as the beginning of Christianity. And it's interesting, this is a church that was, the location was determined by Helena, who was Constantine's mother, and they began to build a sepulcher on that site, which is within the city walls, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And, of course, on the Temple Mount today, you have the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and these are very important to the Muslim faith. During its long history, Jerusalem has been destroyed completely twice, besieged 23 times, attacked 52 times, and captured and recaptured 44 times by different nations. So it's a city that was held in probably more confusion, more challenges than any other city in the world. The oldest part of the city was settled in the 4th century BCE, so it goes back almost 6,000 years. It is considered to be one of the oldest cities in the world. I'm going to go to the next slide. Why do we need to know about it? Well, of course, I think it's pretty obvious. First of all, its history, it is the place of the roots of our church, first century church. The lessons that we're going to learn from this study. Prophecy, it is very central, of course, to end time events. And so when we get into the future of Jerusalem, we'll talk about many of these prophecies from Daniel and Matthew 24 when we get to that part of our series. It is central to worship in the kingdom of God. And, of course, the new Jerusalem will be located on this general spot in the kingdom of God. And we'll talk about that a little more in detail. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the topography of Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem was developed on four mountains: Mount Zion, Mount Acra, Mount Bezitha, and Mount Moriah. And originally it came to be called Mount Moriah. These three peaks basically were called Mount Moriah. Mount Zion you see to the west, Mount Acra, and Mount Bezitha. And you'll see across the Valley of Jehoshaphat, or Jezreel as it's sometimes called, to the east you will see the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives has a higher elevation than Mount Moriah, so that you can stand on the Mount of Olives and you can look down on Mount Moriah. I want you to notice Accra, this fourth knoll, if you will, on Mount, considered, all this considered Mount Moriah. This is the highest point. Now, this is very important for some scriptures we're going to explore a little bit later, is this very high point. So it was originally built on this kind of island of mountains around these two valleys. And you'll notice this valley below, as the valley of Jehoshaphat would naturally flow down off this side. If you were coming up from the plains, and most of the herders, these migratory herders at the time of Abraham, would have been on the plains, that is, in the foothills, much like we have here. We have sheep, you know, in the foothills and the plains. They would be on the plains and the foothills, and if they were coming to this place, they would be coming up this valley from the south and the west. Like I said, that's going to play very important in our study of this particular city. I'm not going to turn there, but the city in Scripture is called Jebus. Originally, before it was called Jerusalem, it's called Jebus. And the reason it was called Jebus is because it was built by a fortification was built on this particular knoll of four hills because it could be well defended. You see all the way around, any enemy would have to come up this valley from the south and come around these mountain peaks to attack anything, any fortification that was built on top of the mountain. And it was built and developed by the Jebusites, who originally came from the land of what we call Turkey today, from the north. They came down, they built this stronghold that David eventually conquered and changed his name to the city of David, which you may recall, but I'm getting way ahead of myself. But in Judges 19, verse 10, it's called Jebus. But first of all, let's go to Genesis 14. Genesis 14, it's the artist's conception of Abraham and Melchizedek. Genesis chapter 14, in verse 17, and the king of Sodom and went out to meet him at the valley of Sheba, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Then Melchizedek, king of Jerusalem, in the Hebrew, or Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the Most High God. And we know from reading Hebrews chapter 7 that this personality is identified as Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ was the angel of the Lord, or the king of Salem, a Salim. So the earliest reference in the Bible is during the time of Abraham, and it's called Jerusalem, or Salem. Abode of Peace. That was its name originally. Now again, when this stronghold apparently sometime later was conquered by the Jebusites, they changed the name to Jebus in honor of the leader of the Jebusites, or the founder of the tribe of Jebus, Jebusites, who became a nation later. Verse 19, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So this is the first appearance in Scripture of any reference to the city of Jerusalem. And this happens about 2110 BCE. So about 2110 BCE, Abraham is associated with the prince of Jerusalem. Then the next reference that we find is found in Judges chapter 19. Let's go to Judges 19. Judges 19 and verse 10. Judges 19 is the story of the priest, the Levite, whose concubine had run away, ran back to her dad's house. And the Levite went to fetch her. And he passed by one of these valleys. And he went to the father's house. And the father said, yes, she's here. And I'm going to give her back to you. And so he gave his concubine back to the priest, who was going to take her back up north along this mountain ridge. And let's pick up the story in verse 10. Judges 19, verse 10. He had a servant or a manservant with him. It says, however, the man was not willing to spend that night, so he rose and departed and came opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And with him were two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. So this Levite is headed back north with his concubine, and he didn't want to stay in the city of Jebus, which was a stronghold at the time. Now, the reason he didn't want to stay there, because he was an Israelite. This is during the time of the occupation, and the Jebusites were enemies of the Israelites. But normally in these cities, they were considered cities of refuge. So if someone wanted to spend the night there to stay away from animals or robbers, they could stay in the walled city and then leave the next day. It was generally acceptable, even though they might technically be enemies. Obviously, a man and his concubine and two donkeys is not a big threat, you know, to a stronghold. And so he could have easily gone in, but he said, no, I don't want to. It says in verse 11, they were near Jebus, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, come, please, and let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and lodge in it. So we know its name, it's Jebus, and it's controlled by the Jebusites at this point in time. This is during the time of the occupation of ancient Israel. What we do find is they were a mountain tribe, these Jebusites, and their capital was Jebus, because it was a very strong, easily defendable, fortified city. It was taken by Judah and burned in Judges 18, but they quickly got it back and they regained possession, and they held this particular stronghold for about 1,000 years until David came along. So the Jebusites lived here for another 1,000 years until the time of David. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. This is an artist's rendition of what this stronghold may have looked like. Big walled cities. A lot of transportation came and went because it was on the route from the Dead Sea where they cultivated salt, if you will, from the sea, and they would carry it over the mountain pass, and it would go right by the valley of Jehoshaphat, right by the city. So it was on a major traffic route. Let's notice Genesis 22. Genesis 22. This brings us to Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac. Genesis 22, of course, we know that Abraham is called by God to take his son and sacrifice him. Again, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but I'd like to focus on verse 4. Genesis 22, 4. Then on the third day, so it was a three-day trip from these plains. Remember, Abraham is a shepherd and a cattleman. He's got all of his cattle on one side of the mountain. Lot is on the other side, which is on the side of the Dead Sea over by Jericho, which we already know. And he travels 3 days and he comes to this place where God is leading him for the sacrifice. It says, on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to go back. Whoops. This is Mount Moriah, and the whole section of all four peaks were called Mount Moriah eventually. Mount Accra is, when you're approaching from the south up this valley, when you look up, that is what you're going to see, the highest peak. you wouldn't see these lower peaks. You would see the higher part. Okay? I want to give you some perspective. Now let's jump back ahead where we were. We're going to run through these slides pretty quickly until we get... Here we go. This is a topographical schematic of the Temple Mount. You see the lower city? The lower city to the lower right, that's the city of David. The upper city is, again, on one of these peaks. We call it Mount Zion, of those four peaks I showed you, right? And then you get the temple, which is Mount Moriah, the temple platform. And then beyond the temple platform is where the peak Acra was, right? Which is up there. I don't know. Can you see possible Golgotha? So when Abraham looked up, what he could see from afar, as he's coming up the valley and he looks up the valley, what he could see was the highest peak. He would not have seen the flat limestone area that many people say is where, particularly the Muslims say, is where Abraham attempted to sacrifice Isaac, which would have been that flat limestone over which they have built the Dome of the Rock. And they believe this is where Abraham attempted to sacrifice Ishmael, not Isaac. All right, Ishmael. It's also, by the way, I've toured there. There's a couple of kind of circular indentions in the limestone. And it is interesting to note the guide who took us through back in 1980, they won't let you in the Dome of the Rock anymore because of the tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. But the guide told us that this is where Muhammad leapt into heaven on his horse. And you can see the hoof prints in the limestone. Now, there's no historical evidence at all that Muhammad was ever in Jerusalem. Kind of interesting. But anyway, that's what he said. So when you're looking up, let me just advance this. This is the Temple Mount on which Dome of the Rock is today. This is the lower city called the City of David. And this up here would have been that higher peak, which Abraham would have been able to see from a distance. And Golgotha, of course, this brings kind of full circle what this pictured. Was Abraham sacrificing Isaac? Was God the Father sacrificing his son? And he would be sacrificed on Golgotha. Which I think is pretty interesting when you look at it from a geographical perspective. Let's go to chapter 22, verse 14. And Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." Now, it's interesting. Commentary that I read said this is usually wrongfully interpreted, "The Lord will provide," or "The Lord who provides," since God provided a sacrifice in place of Isaac. However, the Hebrew word means "will be seen," future tense. By this we can see that the Lord had already chosen Jerusalem as the place where he would establish himself. So Abraham's words and his naming of the place, of this higher ground, "The Lord will provide," technically means "the Lord will be seen," or "God will be seen here in this place." So it was like a prophecy of the location of a place of worship for the Israelites. Okay, let's notice the next slide. This is that higher peak I was telling you about. It's made of limestone. It's a limestone cliff. This is called Golgotha, or the place of the stone, skull. When you look at it from a distance, I don't know if you can see kind of the eyes and just the way it looks. It's called the place of the skull because it resembled a skull. Now, the Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox do not accept this as the place of the crucifixion. But it's interesting, right behind this cliff is the garden tomb where we believe that Christ was laid, in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. And it's right behind this location. And this would have been a very highly visible location, which the Romans loved, to crucify people as a deterrent to future criminals' crime. Today, of course, you have a Palestinian bus station below it. And there's a lot of diesel fumes. And you can't get close to the cliff because it's, if you will, blocked by the diesel bus station. So it's not generally accepted as the place, but it is by the church is taught, this is likely the place. Okay, let's go back to our history again. In the conquest of Canaan, we see that Jerusalem is there in the middle, and that was part of the kingdom of Judah, called the Southern Kingdom. And you get south of the kingdom of Judah and you get into the desert. That's the kingdom of Edom. Just to tell you the distribution of the tribes during the time of the conquest. Although Judah conquered several areas in the Negev and the western foothills, as well as cities such as Hebron and Nebar, their victory was incomplete. Jerusalem, for example, was either not taken completely or later recaptured by its inhabitants. In fact, the Jebusite fortress was not effectively defeated until the time of David. So for 1,000 years, it kind of went back and forth, but eventually the Jebusites recaptured this stronghold and kept it. Another picture, this is an artist's conception of the Jews, or the tribe of Judah, attacking the old city of Jebus. Okay, let's look at the stronghold now of Jebus. And let's go to 1 Chronicles 11:4, which describes this. I want to kind of set the stage for David's conquest of the stronghold of the Jebus, the Jebusites. 1 Chronicles 11:4. And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. And the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, "You shall not come in here." They felt they had a fortified city that no one could conquer. They'd held it for almost 1,000 years, by and large. You can imagine their confidence, right? Nobody can conquer us here. Remember, it's built up on the top of these four mountain ridges, surrounded by valleys. Anybody trying to attack it would have to come from the bottom. In these days, because of the fortified walls, the best way to conquer a city was starvation. Starve them out. Surround the city and don't let any food come in or out. And of course, many cities had to bring in water. But Jerusalem had a unique natural asset. It had a spring. High in the mountains, it had a spring called the Gihon Springs. And these springs supplied enough water for the inhabitants. So when they knew that an enemy was coming, they would just stockpile food and they could survive for longer than the people trying to besiege them could survive. And that's how they basically survived all those years, was the natural spring and the foodstuffs that they had stored up. So they said, "David's not coming in here." In verse 6, David said, "Whoever attacks the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain of the Israelite army." And so Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first and became chief. So Joab conquered the city of Jebus, and therefore he became David's right-hand man when it came to war. It says, "And then David dwelt in the stronghold, therefore they called it the City of David." So he changed the name from Jebus to the City of David. And he built the city around it, from the Milo to the surrounding area. Joab repaired the rest of the city. So David went on and became great, and the Lord of hosts was with him. So this is kind of a summary of what happened. But let's go to, as it says here, 2 Samuel chapter 5. 2 Samuel 5. And we read a little more detailed account. And I remember as a kid, I saw a movie of Joab conquering Jebus. And I was so enthralled because what he did, Joab led his soldiers up the well, if you will, the shaft from the springs, into the city at night and surprised them and conquered them because they were overconfident. And he came up the water, or the well shaft, during the evening. It says here in 2 Samuel 5, in verse 6, "And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David and said, 'You shall not come in here.'" And then they made fun of him, saying, Even the blind and the lame could conquer us, except you won't be able to. It says, nevertheless, in verse 7, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And now David said on that day, whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Therefore they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house of the Lord. And it's based on this Jebusite saying. Then David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built all around from the Milo and inward. So David went on and became great, and the Lord of God, Lord of hosts rather, was with him. So again, we have this summary, but basically what happened, can jump ahead here. See the top of Mount Moriah is in the background again. That's where Golgotha is. You see the city of David, where David eventually built his palace up on top of the ridge, kind of a saddle, and the city of David went downward. The Gihon Springs was right on the wall. So part of it was outside the wall, part of it was inside the wall. That's how Joab could get in. He and his men went into the pool and then up the shaft into the city. This is what it looks like. There's the city of David, which was the old stronghold of the Jebusites. And many of you may recall back in the 70s and 80s that Ambassador College was involved in an archaeological dig in the old city of David. And this is the area where they were working, which is south of the temple walls. And they were unearthing the city of David. And today you can go there and there's a marker, a monument that says this excavation is thanks to students from Ambassador College and Hebrew University who went through this for about 20 years. We were involved there with our students. And this is the area they were excavating. Okay, this gives you a little idea. This is a cutaway of Hezekiah's tunnel, because Hezekiah was wanting to get all the water into the city when he heard that the Assyrians were coming to conquer him. I'm sorry, the Babylonians. So what he did is he had his engineers cut a tunnel that went from the pool of Siloam and the Gihon Springs so that it was inside the city walls completely. And so what he did is he had this tunnel engineered. It's almost a mile long, and they started on both ends, and amazingly they met in the middle. And you see it takes a pretty circuitous route. They met right in the middle. And if you go to Jerusalem today, this is a sight you need to see, unless you're claustrophobic. And then there are some areas where you have to duck over. Remember, you're a mile into the earth or half a mile in the middle. And when you meet in the middle, you can see they were about 2 inches off. And they came from one direction or the other. And the water still flows there into the pond today. So you see Joab entered here, and so did we. You can walk through that down to the pool of Siloam. So what he did is he entered in a pool, and then he climbed up that shaft up to this inside the city. Again, this is a relief of what the city may have looked like. David's Jerusalem, the Gihon Springs, towers to guard the springs, and then the central valley that was all around that protected the fortress. And that again was protecting the springs, which was right on the wall, if you will. Getting a little ahead of myself. Let's go to 2 Samuel 6, verse 12. 2 Samuel 6. Now it was told King David, saying, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God. So David went and brought the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with gladness. And so it was, when those bearing the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, and he sacrificed oxen and fatted sheep, And David danced before the Lord with all of his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. And so David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. So this is very significant, because what David did is he transferred the place of worship, which was signified by the mobile Ark of the Covenant, from Shiloh. It had gone to the house of Obed-Edom, and from there he brought it to Jerusalem. He took a big risk. He didn't know if God would approve this, but God did. It says in verse 18, "And when David had finished offering burnt offerings and peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts." And God honored that. And so he moved this center piece of worship, which was the Ark of the Covenant, he moved it to the old city of David during this time. You'll also notice up here at the top is David's palace. Now, if you look at it from the side, it would slope down like that. So David built his palace up on top, and he could look down and he could see all the houses below in what became the city of David. So when he was up on his rooftop and he looked down, he could see all the other rooftops. And that's how he saw Bathsheba bathing on her rooftop, which was very typical. People bathed on the rooftop. Just to give you a little perspective. So he was up on the crest of the mountain looking down at all the houses, and he observed this woman bathing. So that's how that could take place. Just as kind of a sidebar. This being the old city of David, and David intended, of course, to build a house for God there. Just a couple of pictures regarding the pool of Siloam. This is the way artists believe it looked during the time of David. It was a very important water source. This is the way it looks today. It's a nice big drainage pipe running through it. But if you walk through the tunnel, Hezekiah's tunnel, you will come out into this pool. And it's about 2.5 feet deep. So you wade through the tunnel. It's about 2.5 feet deep. 2 feet deep at times. It elevates a little bit in height, and you'll come out in this pool. So that's what it looks like today. I thought you might be interested in looking at that. This is a cutaway of the Temple Mount. This was David's intent. In 2 Samuel 24, verse 24, I'm not going to turn there, but 2 Samuel 24, 24, David bought the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. And that would be right about there. It was a flat area of limestone. And when the wind came up the valley, it was a great place to be threshing wheat. Because when the wind came up, it blew the hulls away, and you had the meat of the wheat left. So it was an ideal place for a threshing floor. David thought it would be a good place for the house of God. So he bought it. It says in 2 Samuel 24, he bought it for 50 shekels of silver. And this later became the platform on which Solomon would build the temple. But in order to build it, it wasn't quite big enough for him to put the temple that he had in mind. So he built a platform. And you see, this is a platform that he built over this saddle ridge I was talking about earlier. Just below this is the city of David we've been talking about, the old stronghold of the Jebusites. So this is above that. If you're going up in elevation, you're now going up to the next level, and you're going to the north. Solomon built this, if you will, this platform on which to build the temple. Now, you notice this, the only one I could get was from a later period. You see Herod's expanded platform? We're going to see this later, but Herod, when he rebuilt the temple, he expanded the platform to go back, and he built a fort called Fort Antonia that went even further north. But basically, this describes Solomon's original platform wall. You see it on the inside there? This would have been the stables in the front, and then the platform in the back, which would have commonly been called Mount Moriah. Just to give you an idea about how the platform was built. So Jerusalem today looks kind of flat, and you wonder, how is this called a mountain? Because it's been built up. A lot of it's been built up over there. So let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 2 and verse 1. 2 Chronicles 2, 1. It says, then Solomon, 2 Chronicles 2, 1, then Solomon determined to build a temple for the name of the Lord and a royal house for himself, which he did. We know that David wasn't able to complete that. So Solomon is the one who built the temple. This is an artist's conception of what Solomon's temple may have looked like. It was magnificent. You can read the chapters in the Bible that describes the amount of wealth, billions upon billions of dollars of gold overlaid the timbers that he imported in for the building of this magnificent edifice. It was considered one of the wonders of the world of its time. It was a beautiful building. People came from all over the world to see it. Of course, in the Holy of Holies was the Ark of the Covenant, the focal point of worship in ancient Israel. Let's go over to verse 12. I'm sorry, let's go to chapter 7, 2 Chronicles chapter 7. Verse 1, when Solomon had finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. So after he completed it, God put his stamp of approval on it. It says, the Spirit of the Lord filled the temple. Drop down to verse 12 now. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. In verse 15, he said, my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayers made in this place. So God clearly identified this as the place of worship for ancient Israel. And you can understand why this is so important to the Jews today, this Western Wall. They feel the same way. My eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayer made in this place. So this became the focal point of religion for the 40 years that Solomon reigned and after for the southern kingdom of Judah when the kingdom was split. Some other artist's conception of the Temple of Solomon and what it may have looked like when the Spirit of God came in that temple. The temple doors face to the east, and to the east you have the Mount of Olives, which rose up above the Temple Mount and was separated by the Valley of Jehoshaphat or the Valley of Jezreel. And across this valley, they had bridges built where you could walk from the Mount of Olives straight across into the Eastern Gate or the Golden Gate into the Temple Mount area. I'll show you a picture a little bit later of the Eastern Gate today, of the major platform. It's all bricked over. You know why it's bricked over today? Because when the Muslims took it over, they heard of the prophecy that Christ would return to the Mount of Olives and would come into the temple from the east. So they bricked up the Eastern Gate so he couldn't get in. True story. A few more pictures of Solomon's temple and the splendor of it. At least artist's conception of that. Again, this is Jerusalem during the time of the kings, up to Hezekiah, up to the conquering of the city. And you'll see the pool of Siloam, the Gihon Springs, which fed Hezekiah's tunnel or conduit. The lower city is the city of David, which you can plainly see. I don't know if I separated these out. No, I didn't. go back. Then you can see Solomon's city that he built, including the temple. So he kept building up this ridge and building up platforms in order to house all of the new construction that Solomon put into play. I'm going to go to 2 Kings 25 now. Let's go to 2 Kings 25. Which brings us roughly to 586 B.C., the 9th of Ab, significant date to the Jews because of the destruction of the temple. In 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 8, I thought I was there, but I'm not. And in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Jehazadon, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. In verse 9, he burned the house of the Lord and the king's house, all the houses in Jerusalem. That is, all the houses of the great he burned with fire. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem all around. So Solomon's temple was destroyed approximately 420 years after it was built. It was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldeans. And again, this is an artist's conception of how they probably dismantled the temple, tore it apart, took many of the treasures, all the gold implements of the temple. And nobody knew what became of the Ark of the Covenant, which is kind of interesting. That's conversation for another story. Okay, let's go to Ezra chapter 1 now. Ezra 1. And chapter 1, verse 4. Let's go to verse 1. Now, on the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout his kingdom and also put in writing, saying, and he basically made a declaration that the house in Jerusalem should be rebuilt. So 42,000 Jews returned to Jerusalem and began rebuilding. And they started, interestingly enough, rebuilding by building an altar. You know, a lot of people say, how can we have evening and morning sacrifices in Jerusalem again without destroying the Dome of the Rock? And in fact, some probably in this room remember, do you remember a guy by the name of Rowan in 1967? Who went inside the Alaska Mosque with a bomb and a stack of Plain Truth magazines because he felt that the Alaska Mosque and the Dome of the Rock had to be blown up in order to rebuild a temple. But it's interesting, during the time of Ezra, what they did is they built, he was not successful and he was arrested and put in prison. I don't know what's become of him since then, but he was a lunatic, obviously. But all that you need is an altar to start sacrifices again. You do not need a temple. And they already have the example of Ezra, who was given a commission of Cyrus to go, and the first thing they built was the altar, and they began sacrificing before they rebuilt the temple during the time of Ezra. So there's precedent already set, which I think you'll find fairly interesting. So let's go to the next slide. This is the area of Nehemiah's temple. Now what happened? 71 years later, Nehemiah heard of the condition of Jerusalem, and he went and spearheaded a construction project where they rebuilt the wall, and then they rebuilt the temple. It wasn't the same splendorous temple that Solomon had, but let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. 2 Chronicles 36. I'm going to refer to that because that's the decree of Cyrus, which we just read. So let's go to Nehemiah 12. Nehemiah 12 is probably a better place to go. Nehemiah 12, verse 27. Nehemiah 12, 27. And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites in all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgivings and singing with cymbals and stringed instruments and harps. So they rebuilt this area during Nehemiah's time, and these are some artist's rendition of what it may have looked like. You see the implements of construction in the foreground. They built an altar without a temple so they could make sacrifices, and they began sacrifices during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah until the construction of the temple was complete. And then when it was complete, again, an artist's conception of what it looked like. It was very similar, but not exactly like Solomon's temple. Didn't have the same gold and silver and other implements. Again, you see it's built up on the platform. Another view of what it probably looked like. And you can see why the Jews were so happy. Jerusalem was again resettled for a short period of time. And then we enter what I call the intertestament period. This will be the last slide basically I'll show for our service, and then we'll have a break. This is a lot of history in just a few minutes, but basically from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, we read about Alexander the Great, and this history is found largely in Josephus, because the Bible doesn't tell us anything about this history. But Josephus records that Alexander the Great came to Jerusalem to conquer the city, and the night before he entered the city, he had a vision in his dream that he would meet the high priest. The high priest also had a dream, according to Josephus, and he met the people with singing and gladness. And he met the king, the conquering king, Alexander the Great, singing. So Alexander came and met him and actually bowed down to the high priest. And he said, I too want to worship your God. You know, Alexander was one of those guys that covered all the bases. He worshiped all the gods. Wherever he went, whatever temple it was, he wanted to sacrifice. Alexander the Great did. And Alexander the Great bypassed the city of Jerusalem and did not conquer it. Or did not destroy it, I should say. He did conquer. Then in 320, Ptolemy Soter, one of the generals of Alexander, attacked the city on the Sabbath because the Jews were once again making revolting sounds. Sorry. revolting noises. And he began to destroy the city. 200 B.C., the city prospered under Roman government, was rebuilt. Then in 175, 165, Antiochus Epiphanes invaded the city and desecrated the temple because of the Maccabees. You may have heard of Joshua Maccabee, who started basically a Jewish revolt. And the history of Antiochus Epiphanes fills the prophecies of the king of the north, at least in its first. There's a type and an antitype in its first fulfillment of Daniel 11 and 12. But I'm getting ahead of myself. 165, Judas Maccabeus leads a Jewish revolt. Then 160 to 63 BCE, the discord and strife existed in the city of Jerusalem. And finally, Ptolemy captures the city for Rome. In 57, Herod the Great conquers the city and begins rebuilding the temple. And then we have Herod's temple. But now we're getting into the New Testament period. Herod builds a temple to try to please the Jewish people. And then 41 BCE, Herod Agrippa doubles the size of the city walls. And then 4 BCE, Jerusalem is a new city with a newly renovated temple and wall. So by the time Christ is born, this city is brand new, spanking new. And everybody talked about how beautiful the new Jerusalem was. He even called it the New Jerusalem. And it was the gift of Herod, the Herods, to the Jewish people. And so that brings us to the New Testament. So let's have another hymn. And then we'll have a hymn and a prayer, and then we'll have about a 10-minute break. You can get a cup of coffee, take a rest break, and then we'll resume for the second half, Jerusalem and the New Testament.